Good evening. Welcome to The Blues. I'm Lee Hay. On tonight's show, we'll begin the first set with Etta James. Then we'll hear from Charlie Musselwhite, Mose Allison, and Johnny Adams. We'll also hear in the second set Nina Simone's I Shall Be Released and Ernestine Anderson with a live version of Please Send Me Someone to Love. And then we'll also hear a phone interview between Brian Powers and Seymour Stein, founder of Sire Records, who was in town today at the Public Library downtown book signing for his book Siren Song, My Life and Music. He began his music career at King Records, had a mentorship with Sid Nathan, and talks about also the importance of King Records on the blues.
Believe everything you heard. Hush, hush. Just yakety yak all the time. Hush, hush. Just yakety yak all the time. If you don't stop yakking, you're gonna make me out of my mind. Hush, hush, I didn't hear a word you said. If you don't stop talking, I'm gonna leave and I'm gonna be mighty afraid. Hush, hush. Hush, hush. Hush, hush. Hush, hush. Hush, hush, baby, and I believe a word you said. You're gonna drive me out of my mind. Thank you.
In your lonely room, in your darkest hour, think of me, darling. You're my desire. In your lonely room, in your darkest hour, honey, call on me. I took a dark road till I found the sun. Nobody loved me like my baby done. In your lonely room, in your darkest hour, won't you call on me? Find me on the rough side of town. Look for me, darling, when your blues come down. In your lonely room, in your darkest hour, please call on me. Stand out your window, another lonesome dawn. Remember the good times, baby. Honey, come back home. In your lonely room, in your darkest hour, you can call on me. Call on me, baby.
Sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy when skies are gray. You'll never know, dear, how much I love you. Please don't take my sunshine. The other night, dear, as I lay sleeping, I dreamt I held you by my side. Then I woke, I was mistaken. So I hung my head and I cried. You are my sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy. happy when skies are gray. No words to tell you how much I love you. Please don't take my sunshine away.
No one ever saw or wanted to see the real me. I was hiding and sometimes sliding from the real me. No one ever found a reason to take a moment or a season to find the real me. The real me. No one ever knew or wanted to know the real me. When you stood beside me and somehow got inside me and you found the real me. You got through all the surprises, all those defenses and disguises, and found the real me. The real me. Your gentle touch made me strong, showed me the strength that I had all along. And you made all those tangled pieces unwind when you found the real me. The real me. When I look in the mirror, I no longer see the man I used to be. Now looking back at me, all I ever see is the real me. All I ever see is the real me.
That was title track, The Real Me by Johnny Adams, Mose Allison with You Are My Sunshine, from Charlie Musselwhite in Your Darkest Hour from the album One Night in America, and at the top, Hush Hush, Etta James. This is The Blues on 91.7.
They say everything can be replaced. They say every distance is not near. So I remember every face of every man who put me here.
Oh, I see my light come shining from the west down to the east. Any day now, any day now, I shall be released.
They say every man needs protection. Must fall. So I swear I see my reflection somewhere inside these walls.
Oh,
I see my light come shine. Lonely crowd, man who says he's not to blame. All day long I hear him hollering so loud, just crying out that he's not to blame.
To be so lucky. I just don't know.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
To have, to be able to work with. I just have to tell you this. Heaven's blessings to all mankind, understanding, peace of mind. If it's not asking too much, please send me someone to love, someone to love. Show this world how, show the world how to get along. You know that peace is gonna enter. All of the hate is gone. If it's not asking too much, yeah. I want you to serve me somebody that I love, yeah. Hey, yeah. puts an end to his damnable sin. Hate's gonna put this world all in flames, and Lord, 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 it'd be such a shame. Oh, because I'm down here with so much misery, I don't beg for no sympathy, but whoa, whoa. Comes out the very same. That is, unless man can put an end right now to his damnable sin. Hey, put the world in flames. Oh, whoa, whoa, whoa. Whoa, whoa, whoa. What a shame. Oh, because I'm down here in misery. I don't beg for the sympathy. But now, if it's not asking too much, please send me someone to love. Yeah, yeah, yeah. If it's not asking too much, please send me somebody. Just need me one good man. So hey, if it's not asking too much, would you please, 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 one good man. Some ladies got two, but all I want is one. One good man, yeah. Maybe, maybe one of the ladies got mine. Hey, won't you send him? Send him. Yeah, won't you send him? Won't you send him? Send me my man, the one I'm needing, the one I'm needing.
Please Send Me Someone to Love by Ernestine Anderson and Nina Simone. I Shall Be Released from the album Just Like a Woman. Coming up next, a phone interview between Brian Powers and Seymour Stein, founder of Sire Records. And Seymour Stein made an appearance earlier this afternoon at the Downtown Public Library for a book signing of his book, Siren Song, My Life in Music.
Tonight we're talking to Seymour Stein. We have Seymour on the line here to talk about when he used to work for King Records here in Cincinnati and a little bit about his memories about his mentor, Sid Nathan, and his time in Cincinnati and, of course, his great career in the music business. Seymour, thank you so much for doing this interview.
Oh, it's not only a pleasure, but, you know, anything about Sid Nathan, I'm on board. He was the most important mentor I had and like a second father to me.
Now, you have a new book out, and you talk about your amazing adventures in the music industry. You know, you've been involved in the music industry, really, since you were a teenager, since the 50s, and you're still involved now.
Yes.
And this book, one of the people you dedicated to is Sid Nathan.
Absolutely.
Now, Sid Nathan was from Cincinnati, but you're from Brooklyn. Can you tell us how you guys met?
Well, when I was in high school, I would go up to Billboard and read the bound volumes going backwards, because I had kept track of the top hits from the time I was about 9 years old, but I wanted to go back even further. It was kind of a foolish idea, but I got a lot out of it. Billboard was dead center of the music business in the Palace Theater building, and all the record companies were close by, the majors, three of the four majors at the time, and Capitol was in L.A., but RCA was there, Columbia, and Decca. And also the indies were in that same neighborhood, and I met a lot of people up there. And Paul Ackerman, the music editor, was quite generous to me, as was Tom Noonan, the chart editor. Paul invited me on special nights to stay over and come to the music sessions where they decided what the picks were, the spotlight winners, what they were called. Very important. It was particularly important to the indie labels, because a great review in Billboard could cause the jukebox owners and distributors to order upwards of about 75,000 records to put into their jukeboxes around the country. The charts were so slow in those days that if they waited for a record to hit the chart, it would be too late, you know, so they had to get them in quickly. And one night, on one occasion, he said, look, there's a guy you've got to meet, Sid Nathan. He is the most amazing music guy. And I had heard of him, but I never met him. And I stayed there. His comments during this music session were just amazing. Even though he had no say in it, you know, he brought up his records and they listened to his records and all that. And then he invited everybody out to dinner while this whole thing was going on. And he was talking to me. And I think it was getting so late that these people wanted to have dinner. And they said, look, Sid, give us your records. We always listen to our guest records last. And so Sid said to him, you got a few records over there, I see. So one of the reporters said, oh, this is just from Jubilee Records, Jerry Blaine's company, and they're not doing very well. We can review them next week. So Sid said, no, listen to them now. You know, and then they said to him, oh, Jerry Blaine must be a friend of yours. I said, a friend? I'm suing the bastard. I mean, I never heard talk. He was so amazing. And he said, but he's a good record man. And actually, I believe, I can't be sure of it, but I believe one of the records became a very big hit. I think it was Don Rondo's White Silver Sands. I'm pretty sure that was the record. And then we all went out to dinner, and he was so nice. And he must have seen something in me. And he told me that I should come by his office, and he'd give me a whole stack of King records that I didn't have, because they had their distribution in New York office there, too. And, you know, I never met anybody like him then or now. I mean, this is 60 years later, 61 years later. It was 1957. And then we kept in contact. He would come to New York, and I would go see him at his office. And then he said to me, look, summer's coming. Would you like to come out and stay with me and my family? And I'll teach you the music business. You can come for a couple of weeks, maybe 3 weeks, and whatever. And I said, yes. I said, I just, you know, I have to let my parents know. So I thought it was all settled. A couple of days later, Paul Ackerman comes into my office and says, your father just called me, and he told me about Sid Nathan inviting you out there, which I think is fabulous. He said, but your father started asking me questions, and I can't really answer them all because, you know, I just can't. He said, I think what I told him was that Sid comes to New York once a month and he should see him himself. And I said, oh, my God, that trip is never going to happen. But my father came and we met him at his office. And my father said to him, look, I know that you're a very busy man. I won't take up much of your time. I've only got two questions. So Sid says, look, I've only got one question. Do you mind if I go first? And my father said, sure. You know, he said, how much money do you have? Like that. I was so embarrassed. You know, I didn't know what he was doing. And my father didn't expect a question like that. He said, look, I'm middle class. I work in the garment center, but Seymour and his sister have never wanted for anything. Seymour's been to summer camp. I thought I was going to die. I mean, I really did. So he said, look, let me rephrase the question. You don't mind if I'm doing it, my imitation of Sid's voice, do you?
I encourage you.
Okay. So he said, look, do you have enough money set aside to buy Seymour a newspaper route when the time comes? So my father was in a state of shock, even more so than the first question. He said, Seymour's very intelligent. And he said, and he's almost 16 years old now. He doesn't need a newspaper route. He said, I can't do the voice anymore. He said, let me tell you something. If Seymour doesn't go into the music business, he won't amount to anything because that's all he wants to do. And he'll wind up having a newspaper route or some terrible job. So my father, they shook hands and he said, okay, Seymour can go. When I got home that night, my bags were already packed and it was only April. I mean, and I wasn't supposed to go out till the end of June. I was still in high school. And later on, my father and mother became very close with Sid. They would see him when they would go for 2 or 3 weeks to Miami, and he was usually there because he was always in failing health. And his brother David was a big doctor at Mount Sinai and took care of him.
So you come to Cincinnati and you stay at Sid Nathan's house. You're 15 years old. What was your first impressions of Cincinnati? And also, what was your first impressions of King Records?
Well, I hadn't traveled that much at that time. I'd been to Detroit. I was only a kid. Oh, I was amazed at the city, you know, the beautiful river flowing through it. And look, it was small compared to New York, very small. But I think that for a time, it was one of the top 10 most populated cities up to about, I would say, 1920 or 1930. And then, you know, other West Coast cities, you know, just started to outpace it. I loved all the old buildings. It was like, in some ways, a miniature and cozy of New York. Sid would take me around to places over the river and, you know, just to look around. He took very good care of me. You know, he should never have been driving. He was legally blind, but that didn't stop him. It was quite scary, but I just really liked being with him.
And what were some of the things you were doing that first summer at King Records, and what was your memories of that summer?
Well, he had me do a little bit of everything. He had me listen to demos that were coming in, which I loved, and then some things I hated to do. He actually put me on one of the pressing records, and you know, I always was and still am quite clumsy. I was afraid I was going to get badly injured. And ironically, the record I was pressing, I don't know if that was the first year or the second year, was I Love You, Porgy by Nina Simone. And the line, don't let him handle me with his hot hands. And here I'm afraid of getting my hands caught in that press, you know, that machine, is just incredible. But I learned so much. And I met his A&R people. Henry Glover was the best of all. I'm not sure if Henry was still totally there, but he and Sid remained friendly, and he would come in, and they were very close. And Henry was one of the most important people besides Sid in that company.
Now, King was known as an R&B label, but they recorded a lot of different kind of music. You were there. They had the Stanley Brothers.
They started as a country label. That's how they started originally. They had Reno and Smiley, Grandpa Jones, the Stanley Brothers, you know, quite a few other country artists, and they did very well in the country field. I think they were by far the largest independent country label in the United States. They had Moon Mullican, who was a terrific artist, had, you know, big, big hits, I'll Sail My Ship Alone, and I think that was the biggest one. And, you know, King started as a country label, and then within about a year or two, they started putting out R&B.
Like Ryan Harris and Bill Moose Jackson?
Yes, yes, all of that, yeah.
Now, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, because I know I've talked to you in the past about this, is about these independent labels that came out after World War II and their role, like, in the music industry and their effect. Can you describe to people who are not maybe familiar with that history about the importance of independent labels at that time, coming out of the 40s and the 50s?
Yes, I think that you had four majors, and then you had indies. There were some great ones in California, Imperial Records, Lou Chud's label, that had Fats Domino and Slim Whitman, and later on, Ricky Nelson. And you had the Bahari Brothers, who were out there, too. They had several labels. Then you had Duke Peacock in Houston, Texas, which was a black-owned company. Don Roby was the guy's name, and he had great rhythm and blues stuff. There was another really good black-owned label in Chicago, VJ Records. They not only had some of the greatest R&B, but for a short time they had the Beatles, and they had the Four Seasons. Chess was the big record label in Chicago, and you had plenty of indie labels in New York. Cadence Records, which was Archie Bleier, Cap Records, which Dave Cap. Both of those were basically pop labels. And then you had a lot of smaller labels, Laurie Records and Harold and Ember, which was a big doo-wop label. They had the Five Satins, and they were scattered all over the country. And eventually, Henry Stone started his own independent label after he left King. He worked for King for, you know, quite a while.
Yeah, and he was down in Miami.
Miami, yes. And then later on, Atlanta started to burst open, and Bill Lowry, who is a good friend of Sid's, was one of the first to emerge as a label there. And for a while, King distributed one of his labels. But, you know, rap was brought in mostly by the indie labels. And then the majors seize on it. And back then, there were four majors. Eventually, it grew to seven. And now we're down to just three major labels. You've got Universal, Sony, and Warner Brothers.
Now, eventually you started your own record label, but before we get into that about you starting Sire, I wanted to ask, how was King different from all these other independent labels? I mean, you had an inside
King,
of how it worked.
King had their own branches, which none of those other labels did. I mean, at one point, I think the number of branches, they had 24, which were more than any of the major labels had. But for the most part, with the exception of New York and Chicago and I would imagine L.A. too, I hadn't made it out to L.A. during that period, but it was just a one-man operation. In New York, it was three people, and in Chicago, it was probably two or three people, too. And Sid built a studio in Chicago and later on built a studio in New York. And but, you know, he was in charge of it. They pressed the records. They distributed them. They did everything. None of the other independent companies did. None of them had pressing plants or their own distribution.
Would you say that King was the most independent of the independent labels then?
They were totally independent.
You know, Sid brings you in, you know, and you're working for King in high school. And then later on, you actually moved to Cincinnati after a time, I think in 1961, and was like a full-time employee working at
yes.
King Records. And what were you doing as a full-time employee?
I was his assistant. Again, I did everything, and I learned so much more. I mean, this was like going to college for me. I learned so much every day working with Sid.
What do you remember of the actual Brewster Street complex, I guess you would want to call it?
I wouldn't call it a complex. I would say it was complex. You know, all winding passageways, and it wasn't that easy. Thank goodness I was a young kid and I could run around. It was a maze, but it worked. It worked very, very well. I mean, King had so many employees. None of these independent companies had that many employees at all, anywhere close, not even Atlantic. You know, it was by that time, really moving up the chain, and great, great label. I also must say, Gary Wexler, Ahmet Erdogan, Nesli Erdogan were all mentors of mine. I mean, I had many mentors, but far and away, Sid really taught me the business from the bottom up.
Now, Sid, you know, a lot of people would describe him as kind of gruff, maybe eccentric. How would you describe him?
The way he spoke made him sound a little gruff, and he wasn't a very patient man on the outside, but on the inside he was. Look, he kept me, you know, a long time, but, you know, he had a temper, but that never mattered to me, I mean, at all. I mean, he was the best all-round music person I knew. I mean, I'd say even more than Ahmet Erdogan, who is much more revered, and Atlantic really became such a big company, and Atlantic lasted so long, and Ahmet isn't gone all that long, you know. But even Ahmet, you know, we all make mistakes. Ahmet always regretted selling Atlantic to Warner's. Nobody's perfect.
I wonder if you have a Sid Nathan story. Anything that comes to mind? Other than when you first meet him, I know, but maybe when you were working with him at King, maybe a little adventure, because you always were going out with him and running and having different encounters, I guess.
Let me think about that for a minute. You had asked me another question. Why don't we get to that first? You asked me about these other labels, you know, why they, in your mind, and probably you're correct, what were the labels you mentioned?
Or like Chess and Sun and Stax. I mean, people seem to know those names, but people don't seem to remember the King name as well.
First of all, Sun, I greatly admire Sam Phillips. Sun Records really, under his tutelage, under his control, only lasted about 10 years. But he did sign Elvis Presley and Jerry Lee Lewis and Johnny Cash and Roy Orbison and Carl Perkins, yes. So that was an amazing label. In the variety poll of the top 100 labels of the last 100 years, Sun came in at number 9. I don't know where King came in, because they only ever printed the top 20, and it wasn't there. Miraculously, Sire came out at number 15, which blew me away. But I think that the fact that Chess Records lasted a lot longer than King did. Even after it was sold, it was handled better than King was. I mean, Stax gets a lot of credit for breaking R&B in Memphis, but I think to a certain degree it's a little overstated. A great label, but nothing like King. Now, let me just give you a couple of things you should know. In terms of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I don't think any label, independent label, maybe Atlantic, have more people inducted from their label than King, starting with James Brown in the first year, then Hank Ballard also, Freddie King, Little Willie John, Albert King, the Five Royales. Now, Clyde McFadden was inducted probably more for his work on Atlantic, but he got his start in the Dominoes on King. Jackie Wilson, the same thing. He was inducted in the second year as well, and also got his start at King Records. Otis Redding's first record, only one record, was released through King. The Platters' first recordings were released by King. John Lee Hooker was on King. Nina Simone, one of the few jazz-oriented artists that's been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, was on Bethlehem, which was owned by King Records. And then, you know, as a group, the Famous Flames were inducted, James's group, and the Midnighters, Hank Ballard's group. So, I mean, that's an awful lot of artists. I'm sure it's more than Chess, although Chess has had a lot of great stuff, and certainly more than Sun. I mean, probably every artist on Sun almost has been inducted, but they didn't have that many artists. I mean, look, Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Johnny Cash, it's very impressive. And Stax certainly didn't have that many. Chess, perhaps, is more recognized than King, but I know Atlantic is, and maybe they deserve to be because they went on for so long and it's still a very active label.
Well, I think it's more like name recognition. I grew up in Virginia and I knew Chess because the Rolling Stones would talk about Chess, and I knew about Stax because Blues Brothers, you know, all those guys that were in on the Stax label, and of course Motown. But I honestly had never heard of King Records until I moved to Cincinnati in 95. I mean, obviously you know King. Obviously it's very important to you. But I was wondering why it doesn't seem to be as well known. The name doesn't seem to have as recognition. I was wondering if you had thoughts on that.
I think the way it was handled after Sid died, I don't want to make any disparaging remarks about some of the people at King, and I won't do it, but it was Sid's baby. There were two Chess brothers, and Leonard died very young as well, but he had his son that was able to help him, Marshall and other people around. I don't know. I have no idea.
It seems like Sid's family, nobody really was that interested in keeping, after he died, in keeping the label going or even the heritage thing, you know?
I don't know.
At that time, you were already busy starting your own label, Sire Records.
Yes.
But Sid Nathan had a little part of your beginnings with Sire Records, right? He kind of helped you out. Can you maybe talk about that connection with King?
Yes, absolutely. But I really don't know why. I certainly think that at the very least, it's on a par with Chess, and I think that their biggest artist was Chuck Berry. King's biggest artist was James Brown. I would think that Chuck had a longer career, and James Brown's songs, Please, 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 and stuff like that, they were songs that could only be sung by James Brown or properly, whereas Chuck Berry's songs, you know, were great copyrights, and a lot of other people recorded them. I don't know, but King was certainly right up there. I mean, Sid Nathan got in to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame several years after Leonard Chess and Ahmet Erdogan and Jerry Wexler, but he was one of the very first industry people to get in. I think he might have been the next one that got in. I don't think I'm overlooking anybody, but I might. I mean, I don't have this in front of me. And, you know, Sid was in Cincinnati, not New York or Chicago. No disrespect to Cincinnati. When I met him, he wasn't well, and he probably was not well long before I met him. So I think that was part of it. He didn't get around as much as the others.
Well, I think after Sid died, it seemed like the company sort of split up in different parts, you know what I mean? Like the publishing went there and that, and then I think it's only more, maybe since like the Rock Hall of Fame has started, that I think King has been more recognized by the Bluegrass Hall of Fame. Sid Nathan's in there. I think it's only more in recent years that I think people are kind of making the connections about King and all the different music that was recorded there.
Well, I mean, Sid should be in the Country Music Hall of Fame. Forget Bluegrass. I don't know why he's not there.
Probably because he didn't live in Nashville, I guess.
He went down there plenty. He would drive down there. It would scare the pants off me. He was legally blind, but he insisted on driving this big Buick he had. We would stop off in Louisville to see Pee Wee King and Red Stewart, the great songwriters. They wrote Tennessee Waltz, You Belong to Me, great copyrights. And he was very friendly with them. One of the first successful recordings of Tennessee Waltz was by Cowboy Copas.
Yeah, the very first recording was done by Cowboy Copas.
But Pee-wee made a version of it himself,
right,
too.
Right after that. And they came out at the same time. But the story in the Copas family is that he was offered to buy the song, and then it was like $25, and he didn't have the money. And
that's not the story. I'll tell you the story. Sid used to give him money to buy copyrights because he thought he had such great taste by the publishing, not the writership. And he would give him money when he went down to Nashville. This is the way Sid tells the story. He brought in a bunch of songs, and he liked most of them, you know, and, you know, how much money do I owe you? And he gave him the money. And he said, was there anything else? Well, he would usually pay about $10 for the publishing rights. And I think that was the going rate at the time. I don't know. And it was just in advance, you know. So he said, there was one other song. I liked it, but it was too much like the Kentucky Waltz. He said it was called the Tennessee Waltz, and they wanted $50 for that one song. He said, well, why'd you tell him? I said, well, I think it's too much. And Sid said, you did the right thing, boy. Because Sid was telling me, I mean, he knew he made a mistake, but, you know, he didn't try to cover anything up. You know, he was pretty upset when Copas and Hawkshaw Hawkins died and all of that. I mean, he really cared about his artists. He may not have showed it on the surface, but he did.
Well, you were telling me, and other people have told me this, is his widow, Zella, told me that people would stay at the house. He had Hawkshaw Hawkins would stay at the house, and he had a lot of people that would stay at the house, including you, of course.
Hank Ballard stayed at the house. James Brown wouldn't stay at the house because he liked to, you know, go out on the town, and he stayed at a hotel called the Nance. I don't know if it's still there. Cincinnati was a bit segregated then, and I believe it was an all-black hotel. I went down there a few times with Sid to see James, and it was a decent hotel.
Building is still there, not as a hotel, as apartment buildings. You brought up James Brown, and I thought, you know, a lot of people, this when they hear Sid Nathan, I think it's always in context of James Brown. What was your take on Sid and James Brown's relationship?
I thought it was pretty good. I was in the office with both of them at the same time, listening to music, but I wasn't there when they were doing business. Now, it was a bit complicated. James was managed by Ben Bart, and Ben Bart's sister, Fanny, was married to Jack Pearl, who was Sid's lawyer. Even as a young boy, I didn't understand that. Maybe it was a good thing, maybe it wasn't. I don't know. But Ben Bart was pretty tough in many regards.
When you started your own independent label, Sire Records, I think around 1966?
Late 66, we started as a production company and then as a label the next year.
But Sid Nathan helped you out a little bit. Can you talk about a little bit about what Sid did when you started Sire?
Well, he gave me this incredible rental space for $235 a month on one of the best blocks in New York, West 54th Street. It's been torn down, of course, but it was right where they were building and eventually built the New York Hilton. And it was across the street from Alan Dick's, which was a great music hangout. It was down the street from this Italian restaurant where the music people went for lunch. It was a couple of blocks from the Brill Building, even less to 1650 Broadway. It was in the heart of the music business sector. It was a five-minute walk to Billboard. It was just amazing.
And that was the old King Records office in New York, right?
Yes, the old King Records office, yes.
So did Sid give you advice when you started Sire? Obviously he taught you a lot about the business, but did he offer anything about when you decided you were going to start your own label?
I was working in the Brill Building at the time for Redbird Records, Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller and George Goldner. And that was on the 9th floor. FGG Productions were on the 10th floor, and one of the G's in FGG was Richard Goddard. We became very good friends, and we started Sire Productions and then Sire Records. We were trying to come up with a name and everything, and then neither of our initials, you know, SS and RG, there were no vowels. So we took the first two letters of our names, and it came out Sire. It also came out Rise. I love Sire. I said, you know, there's something here. It's like King Records, Sire. And Richard had met Sid a few times, and you know, that's how Sire Records got its name.
You've had a lot of success with Sire Records, obviously. I mean, you had bands like the Ramones and Talking Heads, Madonna, and, you know, Ice-T, the Smiths.
Depeche Mode.
Depeche Mode, right.
And Katie Lang. When I first heard her, I said Sid would go nuts over this girl. You know, she was so great.
Well, you had all this great success, and obviously you have an ability to sort of people that were unknown and see talent in them, which I think is the same thing that Sid had with you and with Henry Glover and stuff. But I was wondering, when you were running Sire, and what were some things that you were with Sid Nathan that sticks with you that he taught you throughout all those decades of all that success?
Well, I mean, I always believed that the song was the most important thing, but he certainly reinforced it. He was a strong believer in the song comes first, and that's how I've lived my whole life with the Sire Records.
You're coming to town here in Cincinnati December 1st, and I know it's been
Looking
some time since you've been
it.
Here. What are you looking forward to? Maybe, I think you're going to see some of the old places, but what is something that you're curious to see, how things look?
Well, I'd like to see the King Building, you know, and see what, if anything, they've done to it. They should make it into a museum. You know, I mean, it's a treasure. I'm sure Cincinnati has other treasures, but probably not as many as some other cities. And it may not be the best location. I don't know how that neighborhood is now, but I would think it would be a good thing to do. You know, it's not that far from downtown, but I hope they do something with it. They shouldn't just, you know, let it fade away.
Well, there's been more effort made that way here in town, but I guess this is kind of a homecoming for you in a way.
Yes, it certainly is in a way. I mean, look, they can't revive what King was as a label, but I think that if they put studios in there, I think that they could turn a profit and also have a great showplace for people to come and see it. Look, I don't know if I can be of any help, but I certainly would. I mean, I would like nothing more, you know, now that I'm not with Warner's, to buy King Records. I mean, I think that it's one of the greatest labels of all time. And, you know, you don't hear much about it, you know, and it's too bad. I think we could breathe life back into it. I think that it would be very, very good for the city of Cincinnati, and I would be happy to do whatever I could to get that going.
Seymour, thank you so much for taking some time out to talk to us.
All right, great.
That was a phone interview between Brian Powers and the founder of Sire Records, Seymour Stein. Thanks for listening to The Blues on 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati and 88.5 WMUB Oxford. I'm Lee Hay.